Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for coming and welcome to the University of Minnesota Bookstores. Before we start, I'd like to invite you to come and check out our website, where you'll find listings of upcoming author events, and you'll also be able to access podcasts of our previous events. Anya's and Sherry's events should be ready in about a week. So we're very pleased to have both of them with us today. Anya Ochtenberg is an award-winning fiction writer and poet. Her book of poetry, The Stone of Language, was published by West End Press after being a finalist in 5 poetry competitions. She is currently working on a book on her multi-genre course, Writing for Social Change, Redream a Just World. She has taught creative writing widely, including at New York University, School of Visual Arts in New York, the University of New Mexico, the University of Minnesota's Split Rock Program, the National Hispanic Cultural Center, at Skidmore College for the International Women's Writing Guild, The Loft, and Intermedia Arts, and with Dropout Youth working with adults and public school children. She's here today to read from her newest book, and I guess some of her other publications also. Her latest book is The Stories of Devil Girl, just published by the Modern History Press. Along with her is Sherry Kwan Lee, and she's the author of the 2002 book Chinese Blackbird. She is also a distinguished alumni of North Hennepin Community College. She's program associate for the College of Continuing Education Split Rock Arts Program Summer Workshops and the Online Mentoring for Writers Program at the University of Minnesota, and has been part of PEP, which is Personal Enrichment Program, team for 7 years. She earned a BA and an MFA in creative writing at the University of Minnesota. Recently retired from 10 years of adjunct teaching at Metropolitan State University, St. Paul, Kwan Lee facilitates community writing workshops at Intermedia Arts and elsewhere. And she is here today to talk about her latest book, How to Write a Suicide Note. So please join me. Sherry's going to read first. Please join me in welcoming Anya Ochtenberg and Sherry Kwan Lee.
Thank you, Terry. I always start with an unpaid advertisement. I work at the Split Rock Arts Program at the University of Minnesota in the College of Continuing Education, which is part of the Personal Enrichment Programs. And my colleagues, some of my colleagues are here today. And I just want them to know that whenever I do go for a reading, I do talk about the Split Rock Arts Program. Hello, Alex. Wow. And just to say that we also have an online mentoring for writers program, which is totally web-based. And truly, I tried it out because I work for the program. And Sharon Dubiago was my mentor. And if it hadn't been for Sharon, well, she was kind of the motivation for me actually getting this book going and written and published. I know suicide. My grandmother committed suicide. So did an uncle. So did a cousin's wife. My niece slashed her wrists. I remember being at the hospital with her. I have a grandnephew, 17 years old, that just this past year tried to commit suicide. None of us know about it until he complained of being sick. And it turned out that he damaged his kidney from taking pills. I myself ended up in emergency twice in suicide attempts. My other attempts were a little more feeble, but just as serious. So I don't use the metaphor of suicide frivolously. And it's not easy to write about. And that said, after my book was published and I went back and looked at it, I realized I really didn't talk about it much. I kind of avoided it. Instead, what I did was use it as a metaphor for the things in my life, the racist, sexist, classist things that were killing me, that are killing me, or whatever. But then I read a quote by Clarissa Pinkola Estes that made me know that I was on the right path to understanding. She says, "What must I give more death to today in order to generate more life? What do I know should die but am hesitant to allow to do so? What must die in me in order for me to live, to love? What not beauty do I fear? Or what use is the power of the not so beautiful to me today? What should die today? what should live? What life am I afraid to give birth to? If not now, when? There are many women in my life, there are many women, especially women of color writers, who have saved my life. Their story is very familiar. The anger, the pain, the confusion, the loneliness, the abuse, the struggle, the triumph, the beauty, the passion, the creativity, the love. Nikki Giovanni wrote, "And if ever I touched a life, I hope that life knows that I know that touching was and still is and always will be the true revolution." Alice Walker asked, "What can I give you to help you stay strong when you feel the world is turned against you and that you are standing, perhaps even naked, absolutely alone? I give you this poem." So I'm going to read a few poems from Chinese Blackbird, which has just been reprinted by Loving Healing Press, which is great because now I don't have to sell it out of the trunk of my car anymore. It was originally published by the Asian American Renaissance in 2002. And the first poem is Chinese Black Woman. "I am pregnant with myself, gestation 50 years, oh, revision, 60 years. I will come out standing on my head, knowing truth is upside down. No one will slap this Chinese black woman or proclaim her identity. I will pass out pink, blue cigars, celebrate." I think it belongs, I belong in the book of Guinness Book of World Records because it's an awful long pregnancy of 60 years. But at least I have an excuse for midlife fat. I don't know why I'm so nervous. I've done millions of readings, but I am. And this is a poem that is often requested. Black women often write about hair, and this is my hair story. It's called Magnolia Cafe. "We ate red beans and rice, blackened catfish with hot pepper sauce, and drank lemon water. The conversation flip-flopped, graduate school, marijuana, poetry. She said Vanessa Williams didn't become black until she lost the Miss America title, and she still is only black when she needs to be. And of course, OJ has never been black. I had been questioning my own blackness all weekend at the Celebration of Black Writing Conference. What is black? Skin? Attitude? Language? Hair? The black manager at our local, specializes in ethnic hair salon, said, I don't have black hair. Who told me that I did? Mama, I tried to say, but before I could, my black friend, her hair and dreadlocks, screamed, who are you to say my friend isn't black? She has hair just like my mom's. Are you saying my mom isn't black? All those Minnesota ladies in and out of the tanning booth getting an earful. Her hair might be mixed, but it certainly isn't black. Were they talking about hair or the color of my skin? What is black? Are there membership do's and don'ts? My culture is white. Mama had a passing Jones. My ethnicity is multi-complex. People assume I am Italian, Puerto Rican, Mexican, Native American, etc., etc. I speak the truth. Black. But I lack credibility. Perhaps I should only eat at Asian restaurants, or better yet, only in Lena's Pancake House. Yesterday I braided my mama's hair. Lenore, who works at mama's nursing home, asked mama, you look Indian, what are you? I knew mama wasn't going to respond, so after a long pause I said, she's black. I had to undo the braid before mama would go down to the cafeteria for watermelon. What is black? One drop or a gallon? A popularity contest? A poor me contest? Can you have money and still be black? Be educated and still be black? Have a Chinese father and still be black? Have an Irish great-grandfather, son of a plantation owner, and still be black? Black or not, can I still eat red beans and rice? And sometimes we don't know the exact truth or have all the answers, and we have to kind of imagine. So I imagine I'm a virgin birth. And the title of this poem is called Parthenogenesis, which is a scientific term for virgin birth. It's in sections, but I'm not going to read the section numbers. Mama swears she didn't have sex with her husband after my sister Sheila was born. Abracadabra, Dad disappeared, but I arrived 10 months later. The whip-tailed lizard and the dandelion also are sperm-free. The water flea says yes when it needs to, and Molly's just needs stimulation. Scientists claim sex is a mystery. I like a good mystery. A friend asked, if your dad isn't your father, how can you be Chinese? I replied, if my great-grandfather is white, how can I be black? My mother is Sarah Colley. Am I a woman or a man? What gender is Jesus? In spite of mythology, virgin births will always be daughters. But couldn't I be the son father almost waited for, if only he had used his imagination instead of his magic? Abracadabra. From Chinese Blackbird. And from my new book. And actually the full title is How to Write a Suicide Note, Serial Essays That Saved a Woman's Life. That second part is kind of important. I'm a hockey mom. I just thought I'd say that because sometimes, there's this world of stereotypes out there, and being a hockey mom can mean something to some people, and to others it means other things. Identity is very complex. This is a poem about my Chinese father. Well, actually, it's not about him. It's about someone asked me to write about him, and I really didn't want to. So you want me to write about my Chinese father. Asians are in, you say. Write about your father. Did I tell you he was short? I am angry. This is a good time to write. Kung fu, lucky bamboo, Chinese calligraphy. Asians sell books, you say. Write about your father. Prosperity, good fortune, happiness, and health. When you are angry, keep writing. East meets West. My father left China when his father died, left his mother, brother, and sister, never to see them again. I am not angry with my father. An immigrant, father was 9, a kid fending for himself, selling vegetables off the back of a flatbed truck. Your father is exotic, you say. Write about your father. Mandarin collars and takeout food box purses, have you ever seen those? Made in China, mail-order brides, girl babies. My father left me when I was 5. He was supposed to marry a Chinese bride, but he gave up all things Asian. Fed us chow mein. Stopped speaking Chinese. Prayed Catholic. Your father is Chinese, you say. Write about your father. Father liked to gamble, bet black babies and a wife for a whiter kind of life. I have much to say about my father. Father went to college, mother had an 8th grade education. I don't want to hear about your black mother, you say. Tell me about your Chinese father. Mother was born here, slavery not a choice. Living in America has different meanings for different people. Father was proud, mother ashamed, neighbors had guns. I have more to say about my father. Stop. Read what you have written. Stop. Play rock and roll music, dance, shower. There are no photos of me and my father together. Dress if you had some place to go, something to do, someone to be with who understands. Wear something sexy, something quirky, something thematic, high heels or steel-toed boots, something that will make men pay attention. Walk out the door, get in your car, have fun, buy flowers, be beautiful. Don't think about your father or the man in the woods who is sleeping. Later, there will be time to revise. And this poem I'm going to read because a number of my colleagues are here, a number of people from the College of Continuing Education, St. Paul campus. Thank you for being here. You're probably going to hear more about me than you'll ever want to hear. But this is for you, and this is actually was inspired by a colleague, actually my boss, who was cleaning one day, and it's called Avoidance About Writing. Recently, a colleague started cleaning shared office space in a fury, frantically dusting and polishing and sweeping and moving clutter from one environment to another or trashing it. She admitted she was avoiding yet another challenging job responsibility. Soon, everyone in the office was cleaning. The writing process for me is about avoidance. I don't write. I clean my house, I go shopping, I watch a movie, sex, sleep. Eventually, the writing will win. No dirt, no money, no libido. I gather my tools, coffee, cigarettes, potato chips, red licorice, and dark chocolate. Sit at a dining room table. Shuffle papers. I pee. I smoke a cigarette. I drink coffee. Writing happens when it happens. What is it you don't know you must get rid of? I know I know something, or I wouldn't be sitting here. Writing is a literary vacuum. It sucks up and eliminates. I write on recycled paper. Slash and surrender. Exchange dead words with alive ones. As the first draft simmers, I continue to revise, scrutinize the tone, the rhythm, the meaning. Draft number two is ready to print before draft number one has finished printing. Each new draft allows me to live vicariously. Clutching draft number two, I disappear to smoke a cigarette and read aloud. If I'm at a house in the woods, I read to the Gordon Setter. My creativity exhilarates me. A sassy word, a delicate word, a word that sings or a word that singes, tires me. If the man of the house is around, he will stand next to me, listening, smoking. He will touch me, kiss me, distract me. Eventually, I will toss the writing aside. Lovemaking, part of the process. On a good day, the process repeats itself, and again, I've got cleaning and sex on my mind. I'm not reading any of the really dark pieces. This is called Love Letter, You Should Have Been There, and this is my last poem. Love Letter, You Should Have Been There. Dearest, this is not a Dear John letter. This is a love letter. A love letter to you or to me. I'm not sure. Won't be sure until the writing is done, until the process has exhausted itself, until the book has been written and on the shelf. The process has not always been the same, will not always be the same. I didn't understand change until the last sentence presented itself. Future is not found through complacency. To write is a process, a journey. To live is the same. The process for one poem, one story, one book is never the same. Change is the only truth. Process depends on overall character, depends on the heart of the book, the blood flowing. To end a relationship is a process. What worked for the last ending won't work for the next one, for this one. Won't work to end our relationship. Our hearts and blood are sick and thin and tired. The process of who we are goes back several generations. We are connected in ways we will never talk about, not connected in ways we say we are. Our relationship, like plastic, won't disintegrate. It is possible to light a match, to set fire, to melt, to liquefy. It is not possible to write the last chapter. It is not possible to disappear. This chapter I am writing is the first chapter, another beginning. We will gain composure, solidify, contaminate. I need a new process. I need to mix glass with stone, with sweat. I need to break down, to sever, to turn to salt, to slice, to mash, to grind, to speak, to sing, to sway, to leap. I need to set aside stale processes, unworthy of this journey, this cycle, this new beginning. I need a new list, no rules, funky aphorisms. I need jasmine and eucalyptus. I need conversation. I need pizzazz. I need a photo, a self-portrait of the person I want to become, the person I already am. I need a photo of me locked in a frame that breathes, that flows, that fluctuates, yet remains stable. I will throw away splintered frames with cracked glass. I can condense, simplify, and adjust to one photo, one me. You are not in this photo, and you are not stored in a closet in a cardboard box. You will never be recycled again. You should have been here last winter when I grabbed a young man on the street who merely said hello. I was hungry and ate and sipped a glass of wine. You should have been here last spring. My prayers were answered, hostas in a borrowed garden. Next year, there will be continuity. There will be beauty. You should have been here last summer when the heat and humidity rendered me naked on silk sheets. My sweat sensuous, my bed tossing. You should have been here this fall when leaves turned without you, when I traveled to New Orleans and trumpets blared. This is about lonely. This is about love. This is about driving to the woods for a fix of your skin, for conversation, for definition, desperation. This is about the 5-mile radius you live in. I live far away with no amenities except diversity, which is oxygen, not a well with soft water. This is about painting ceilings, fixing cars, watching movies, riding bikes, and eating sushi, about things lost, about the color purple. This is about family and dogs and neighbors, about exclusion. This is about history, about scotch, about coffee, about sex, about cigarettes, about the future, about nursing homes. This is about ministers and priests, about fantasies and horrors, about what we despise, what we desire, about velvet trousers, about heavily starched shirts. This is about the sting of what I thought I could never have, the bite of knowing it still doesn't fit, the ache of pretend. This is about not being mean. It's about metaphor. It's about getting at truth without spitting. It's about a new way of writing, a new way of living. It's about story, about understanding story. It's about kindness. It's about love, about what gets in the way of love. It's about goodbye. It's about hello. It's about the lost art of letter writing. It's about not knowing how to end. Clarissa Pinkola Estes says, love in its fullest form is a series of deaths and rebirths. We let go of one phase, one aspect of love, and enter another. Passion dies and is brought back. Pain is chased away and surfaces another time. To love means to embrace and at the same time to withstand many, many endings and many, many beginnings, all in the same relationship. Thank you very much.
It's very nice to read in a bookstore, right? There's no better place. Well, you know. This is so carefully planned and timed, sort of, I promise. First, I'm going to help myself breathe, and maybe everyone. This is called Breath. This is from my second book of poetry. It's around. Breath. This is an ode to my breath that circles the body and its stutter, its ache and bend, its opening and its bloodfall, its upheaval and the long string of pleasure that falls from it and is woven into the eye and hand of memory. This is an ode to the darkness behind my eyes, to the green pit that has darkened and left its shell in the cellar of night. This is the time when flowers come forth to suck at my lips, and the honey that passes between us is a soft whisper, bathing the ear in moisture and heat. This is the night when the spine becomes the straight road of the body, up to the head and down to the place of hushed entrance. These are the fingertips that split open and were healed, that stroke the life into things and mend, stitch by stitch, that which has been torn apart. This is a blessing of feet, their bones and veins, the splendid edifice of toes huddled against each other. This is an ode to the breath, excited, tender, steady, musical, warm and hushed, raising its open mouth to all that may fall from the sky, a blessing be upon its soft and shining name. I wanna say in public that I have morphed into a novelist, not a short story writer. There's nothing short about my stories, apparently. And it's been quite an extraordinary work for me because I really was some kind of attempted poet. It's like an attempted crime. But I recently, after years, revised a novel. There's an excerpt of it in Harvard Review. And I submitted it back to a publisher that read it the first time and said, really, really, I really like this, but... And so I've butted around with it for a while, and hopefully. What I'd like to do is read a couple of little sections from the novel that I'm working on now, for which I did get a little bit of money from the state, which is very nice, but... And then I'm going to read some from this novella, Stories of Devil Girl. This precedes this in terms of the writing. But these excerpts are from what I'm working on now, which is a novel called History Artist. And History Artist is about a young woman born in Cambodia. She's born of a Cambodian mother and an African-American father. And she's born at the moment the bombing of Cambodia by U.S. forces began in 1970. So this is called History Artist. So she then is black and Cambodian. She eventually connects to a relief worker who's from Boston, and who she goes back with him, and various things happen. Anyway, here's a couple of little sections from that. Her name is Devi Mao, which actually means black angel. Devi felt like a girl still, 3 years after Edward had brought her from Cambodia. Alone in the house, she was frightened. This was funny to her. I am the queen of alone, she had announced to him when he said he was going on yet another trip, this time to see his mother. You can come with me. Why don't you come with me? It would not please your mother to see me again. What's that supposed to mean? She was perfectly nice to you when she was here. Yes, perfectly, like a zero. Sometimes you really are crazy, crazy enough to keep away from the crocodile. I'm asking you once more, and then I'm going to finish packing. Come with me. Please come with me. You can do anything you want to when we get there. You don't have to sit and talk with her all day. I have business to discuss with her anyway. Yes, business. Not for me to understand. But when you met me, I did business. Taking money for sewing is not doing business. It's just a job, what every working person does. You don't understand or won't say, I did business. Enough now. I was business. Business was here, in me. Look, I have to get going. Don't you want to see my business? Don't you want to check my business, see how I do it? See if I know enough about it to sit with you and your mother like a person and talk? Discuss, I mean, this business? He headed for the bedroom. He was trying not to yell at her. He hated when she brought it up after these years of his saying nothing. He could see her, that girl she was, that little girl, and what he knew could kill him. He went blind for that moment, with rage or with the wash of the years, the forgetting what he had to do to love her. Not the beaten child within her, but the woman, lovely, desiring, grown. He zipped up his suitcase, half-packed. He would buy whatever else he needed. There's money in the usual place, in the drawer, he pointed. She was standing in the doorway. Oh, so we can do business. Stop it. Don't be an idiot. To eat, to buy new sneakers. She lay on the bed and looked over at him. I know everything any person could know about business. Business is in me. Here it is. And what she did then was horrible to him, but he knew it was true. And you can put yourself right here in my business. I give you for free. Big sale today, free sale, but next time you pay double. Stop it now. Now that's business. I have to go. Oh, but this is American business. You can tell your mother I am a businesswoman and a friend to the Americans, a patriot in my business. He was frightened. He knelt by the bed and lifted her hand from between her legs, kissed it gently. She was small today. Her whole body fit into his arms, sweet snail curled into herself. He lay down with her and wept behind her. She was silent. She could not see. Just a crack in the ceiling, a whisper of rain. She went there and all the words were gone. She was a child in the rain, and Edward, he was not even there. I'll stay home, he said, many minutes later. Good, she said without thinking, and began to unroll her body against him. No more business. This is another little section from History Artist. Devi becomes pregnant with Edward, and she does not want to have the baby. And she says, well, it would be too mixed up, because it would be black, Cambodian, and white, too mixed up. There are no doubt other reasons why this is a terrifying possibility for her, to have a child, to need to be a mother. But here's a little section from that. Here's a deal she wants to make with Edward. Dream this baby, she wrote on a scrap of paper. If you can dream it, I will have it. She slipped the note under Edward's office door. He unfolded it and read her careful print. Easy for her, he thought. She's always in a dream world. He left a note on the bathroom mirror. I don't know how to dream. Help me. If this baby couldn't find its form in this white man's dreams, she wouldn't have it. You have 3 months to learn, she wrote back. Sign here. He did. Under his name, he wrote, if, with an arrow pointing outside. She followed a trail of arrows until she came to yellow sheets of paper flapping from a bare limb on the maple tree, one word to each square. You, help, me. She laughed. She would love him if she could. She sat down in the lounge chair and dozed. This time she would watch herself dream and then tell him how. If he couldn't do it, she would get her first wish. She would kill the child. She could be a mother or a monster. She could kill a baby. That would prove who she was, to kill what they'd made with their wild twining, with their cries, with their pleasure. She might be a murderess, but she would be true to her word. She would try to teach him how to dream. They went to the pond that night. First, she told him, you must leave your feet. What? Leave them, leave your feet, bring your mind up from them. They cannot help you. In dreams, even if you are walking, you don't feel the ground. You are breath, a trail of wind following someone else's footsteps. She would not let him wear his white sneakers, but only his black shoes, the one soft on the bottom. He could not see his feet. She could not see them. He was white shirt and impossible hair, old man's hair, angel's hair. She could see his mind alive in the night behind his thin face. She was frightened. For him to fly his thoughts through the darkness after only one lesson meant it likely he could learn to dream. Mother, she turned away from him and spat the word out, then stood right where it had landed. She looked down at her feet, lifted one, then the other, putting them down as if to crush fruit, make wine, seal her refusal to have this child. You passed tonight's lesson. How do you know? You are stumbling, and he was. He clung to the backs of benches, to the low limbs of trees. You can't hold on, she said, or you will never learn to dream. Live above your feet. He arched his spine, threw his head back, mouth open. Drink night, get drunk, he gasped. Stumble, she said. He fell. Now you are dreaming my dream, she thought, and dabbed the edge of her coat on his bloody knee. She pinched a bit of earth and pebbles and rubbed it into the wound. Dream this now, dream, she yelled, short, piercing notes. He pulled away. You're crazy, he said, but I dream. Do you want me, mother, for your baby? Yes, you damn fool. He picked the grit out of his knee. Get up. You must get filled up with night, with darkness. He rose and brushed off the seat of his pants. He looked square at her. What do you want? So when I work on that one, I'm like walking up and back in my little apartment, and I'm out of my mind. I'm really out of my mind. But now I'm nice and normal. however, when I was working on this one, this one I worked on for a long time. I'm going to read a couple of sections of the Stories of Devil Girl, which started half in poetry, half in prose. It was before I decided I was going to be a novelist, which is the thing of all things in the world I was sure I could not be. So I'm going to read two sections from it, short, and one's from when Devil Girl is kind of a child, and one is from when Devil Girl is a little bit older, and she's pretty much a mostly homeless young woman in New York City, which I hear is a lot of fun to be. I've heard that from myself. Anyway, this is called The Birthday Girl's Requests. So, I am the devil's child, and the food of Eden on earth sticks in my craw. So, special day or not, don't stuff my throat with pink cotton candy swirled to the consistency of an old man's beard in the tornadic winds of the candy machine bearing down with its rattling wheels on the work of ants. I'm already through with childish things. Don't throw me a ball with red and yellow stars on its galactic belly. I'll pierce it with a look. I'll deflate it with the edge of the moon of my pinky nail. Don't swathe me in fuzzy pajamas with bunnies cavorting over my baby fat. I know what that leads to. And for the sake of your health, to avoid my child's ire, my nighttime eruptions, my experiments with explosives, my carefully framed leaks of tales you told about the neighbors and the co-workers, don't send me one of those birthday cards with my age in gigantic red type, as if I'm blind as well as captive in this refugee New World soap opera. No green peas, no board games, no throwing the ball around, and no kitties except violent ones, tiger-striped. The insect world is a comfort. Birds, yes. Foo-foo dogs, no. Standard suburban lassies running the chained-in green draw my spit and can only bark and paw at the accident I've been in. Rin Tin Tin has a name I can dance to, but German shepherds are reminiscent of forced flight, so please toss the stick to a mixed mutt with a wise face and a shadowy heritage, or Rover might not make it to my next birthday. And today, on my special day, surrounded by my nuclear family, let me answer your questions. Genealogy? A death sentence. Cancer, heart disease, diabetes, inverted wombs. And sisterhood? Not beautiful. She's threatening blood because it's my day. I'm the malformed urchin foil for her, the large pink version named for a Catholic saint in the confusion of arrival in the New World, the one who draws boys like piglets to pudding. I am gender troublesome, too smart, too silent, too dark, and capable of storms only heavy hands can harness. Which reminds me, no little drummer boy drums, please, in case you were thinking of a gift. I've been drummed on myself, and I have compassion, at least, for the stretched skin targeted by hands and sticks. Give me a book instead and forget where you put me, or I'll write a curse especially for you. Down on the baseboard and print so small you'll go to your grave in a blind convulsion of ignorance. So you think I don't know my place? I do. The bare branches are my home, and my mirror, my devil's claws reaching for the sky. Well, now let's get to the celebration. Cupcakes with my age on them and pink icing, creamed corn instead of peas, spaghetti instead of tuna. I know what's on the menu. Nothing special for my birthday. The menu in the projects is usually the same, except for the occasional show-off holiday meal. but I am a fussy little eater, they think. After every holiday dinner, the fish I will not eat swims to me and gives me his glistening belly, his salt blood, his fins of angelic translucence, shows me the waves pulled from the ocean's heart, the hope for the top. Sometimes they force me, though I yowl like a sacrifice. The lamb bleeds, the meat is given, the cries forgotten, but I taste the bloody carcass for days, sleep curled around the flayed back beneath the swaying bodies, feet sticky with it in dreams, the sound louder as the bloody walker comes up to my bed, my little neck so easy, blood in my nostrils, snapped branches, eat, they're chanting. Eat. And this last section is called Marriage Rituals. And there's a little quote at the beginning I need to read from you from a book no less called The Essential Talmud, which is not a book I read often, but somehow when you're looking for quotes, you read all kinds of things. Anyway, marriage rituals. Talmudic law established that when a man and a woman decide to wed, the man need only say to the woman in the presence of two witnesses that she has now become his wife through one of the accepted forms of marriage, symbolic handing over of money, written guarantee, imagine that, or sexual intercourse. When the act takes place with the concurrence of both parties, boom, a marriage has occurred. Okay. Marriage rituals. It is a cold winter, unusually so, and the radiator hisses but remains cold, and my hands stay gloved, and the tea is thin, but I am inside now. I would begin my story, I would stop time with it, I would dance with the darkness into the rhythm of the tale, but the creased page of my burdens remains silent, remains bare, in the holy night of cursing rising from the streets, full of the hiss, but not the heat I need to spin. There is a way to be warm, the old way, the way they pointed to at home but then dropped their arms and abandoned hope at the sight of me. But now I have been asked. I was pouring coffee and scraping grease, sallow and pink and strapped into apron, writing on green pads and counting change, and I was discovered and asked. As with all young women, deviled or not, thoughts turn to marriage, having been almost married in stairwells, almost married in back seats, almost married in the balcony of an old Brooklyn movie theater, almost married in an alleyway, and close enough in the park at night before there was a curfew, I say why not, and look to join my future to another. Having been dressed up, or half-dressed, set on the table, not to sing childish songs, but in the hush of nakedness, to display the list of parts in the order called out by the ringmaster, I know that presentation is half the deal, so I work on this, and call my new acquaintance, the one that makes a few bucks arranging marriages. At the meeting with my potential husband, the devil makes me dance, and the oscillating fans in the hot Bronx apartment raise each veil until it settles in a heap of nylon on the thick shag rug. I guess I am in a bit of a hurry, being not so much hungry for love as hungry. He is older, an East Indian man from the Caribbean who wants very badly to stay here in the United States. He comes to see me in my little room on 9th Avenue. We agree early on that we will go through with it, and he comes by every few days to drill me on the things I have to be sure of to face immigration. I have to study a list of the dishes he likes to eat. I have to know what kind of shampoo he uses, what brand of razor blades he shaves with. I have to know what he does at his job, what time he leaves for work, and when he comes home. We agree on the price. It's more money than I've ever had in my hands, and I'm so tired of claustrophobic offices, dingy coffee shops, cold, monotonous factories where I sell myself, and unemployment lines when nobody will buy. We are married in a civil ceremony at City Hall, traces of the chocolates he brought me to clinch the deal still lingering in the corners of my mouth. He holds me up in front of the judge, careful to keep me from swooning with the emotion of the moment, or tripping in the borrowed heels that make me taller than him. I leave a few things at his place in the Bronx in case someone from immigration comes to check. After he gives me the money, he starts, I think, to feel like he really does own me. And to tell you the truth, that's kind of a relief. Perhaps if he owns me, he'll take care of me. His body is thick. He eats well. He feeds me curries and fragrant rice with plenty of wine. The more he feeds me, the more he handles me. The deal moves along when he pulls me down to sit on his lap. He holds me around my waist with a meaty arm, an arm covered with silk and black hair. He gives the shell of my ear his whisper, his constant proposal, his wish to make the paper we have signed vibrate with agreement, and then pushes his thigh up hard between mine. I know I have already been sold. I don't much care what else happens. He holds me in the heat of his lap for a long time, and it feels good. His fingers are thick and soft, and he reaches for what he has bought. By the dim light thrown inside from the concourse, he puts the wine glass to my lips. The warmth of the wine spreads as it slips down my throat to where his other hand lies. I can't see his face or understand his distant language. His words are only heat in my ear. If I remember right, it is then he takes me to bed. It doesn't really matter. He has paid, and that's the way these things work. I do remember lying on my back next to him, watching his belly rise and fall. I grab the wine glass from the night table, and after a deep swallow, pour the rest down the slopes of my body. Red streams, red roads, scars, tracks, incisions, evidence falling onto the sheets. His meaty hands reach for me. I become very still, except for the sweet red rivers searching me. I startle him when I take the empty wine glass, smash it on the bare wood floor, and grind it to crystals with a bloody shoe, a bloody hand. Well, I think time is up. Things get better. It's quite a redemptive little novella, as are all my works. So anyway, I thank you very, very much. It's a beautiful day, and you were inside, and that's highly commendable. So thank you so much. This is a time when you get to throw tomatoes and, you know, little bits of dark chocolate with ginger in them, if you happen to have any of those, which, or you know, want to say or ask or tell anything or stuff, right?
Right.
Or leave.
Any questions for either of us?
Well, we could all go dancing. With which I'm obsessed, actually. Yes, it's true.
How do we get your books?
I believe they're here.
They're right here.
Yeah, they're yeah. And the bookstore is carrying them, and yeah, so not out of the car.
And both of her books are published by Loving Healing Press, which is an interesting story in and of itself. Anya did an online interview with them about a year ago or something like that, and they were interested in her work, and because I'm her friend and live next door, she told the publisher about my book, and I tell you, the quickest acceptance, within an hour, I had an email back saying I'll do whatever I can to get your work in print because it's important. And we were both kind of concerned because this press has never done literature before, in the sense of what we write. I mean,
yeah,
poetry,
done a little
and
bit.
Done little bit, yeah. Some memoirs. Yeah, they do a lot with post-traumatic stress syndrome, but more text kinds of books. So the publisher actually started a whole new section of the publishing company in order to accommodate our books. And so he now calls us the Devil Girls. But Anya's book, Devil Girl, is number one in the series. And How to Write a Suicide Note is number 2, and then they republished Chinese Blackbird, which is number 3. So,
And they're actually
really blessed.
Yeah, and they're actually, I mean, they're really expanding this series, and they're, you know, and so we're scouts for work, which is a way to get very popular.
Yeah. When?
I know that previous to this, they've done, I believe, anthologies of work of Vietnam vets. I had connected them to some friends of mine out east who are really wonderful poets and vets. I think what Modern History Press, what this imprint wants to do is to have people's stories come forward that are somehow, you know, fully, that are somehow in context of what the heck goes on the planet. So, which is why they call it, I guess, Modern History Press, that they feel in some way is not representative in any kind of simplistic way, but that has a kind of connection to the events of and the conditions of history and of current conditions as well. So, yeah. So memoir, poetry, I mean, they're looking for various kinds of things. So, yeah. Well, thanks. No. Don't you want to ask where I got my shirt? I mean, is this, I got it in the global market at the Indian place, at the East Indian place. And yeah, and they're incredible stuff. So, yeah. So I get 10% if you go there. No, I don't. I get nothing. Thank you very much.